from KQED.
Welcome to this morning's Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. John Walker Lynn made worldwide headlines when he was captured, dirty and thin, with the Taliban in Afghanistan. The 20-year-old from Marin County was dubbed the American Taliban, and he was president of a prison uprising that claimed the first U.S. casualty in the war in Afghanistan, 32-year-old CIA officer Johnny Michael Spann. Lynn has spent the last 17 years in federal prison for providing support to the Taliban, and he has been released today. And joining us to talk about Lynn is Kathy Gilsonan, national security reporter for The Atlantic, and welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thanks.
I guess the place to begin, since you've been covering this and writing about it, is with the sentencing. This was a sentence handed out for 20 years originally, and he was let out 17 for good behavior, but he was sentenced for, and people may not remember this, essentially a guilty plea that he offered for services provided to the Taliban. He could have gotten much worse. He could have gotten a life sentence, right?
Well, initially, he was charged with, there was a 10-count indictment that included things like conspiracy to kill Americans overseas. Ultimately, though, they pled out to much lesser charges. And so 9 of the original 10 counts were dropped, and he pled guilty to this support for the Taliban, which was illegal under a 1999 Clinton-era executive order after that took place after al-Qaeda had bombed the embassies in Africa. And then he also, so we got 10 years for that, and then he also pled to carrying a weapon while committing a felony. So he got another 10 years for that. I mean, it's interesting that only half of the sentence had anything to do actually with his support for the Taliban.
Well, there's been a great deal of concern expressed about his being released today, not only by the parents of Johnny Michael Spann, the CIA operative who was killed. And we should mention that Lynn was there, but he was apparently not involved or not charged with being involved. But there's been, for example, earlier today, Secretary Pompeo said that it was that his release was unconscionable and it was wrong. It was troubling. I mean, he went on with some pretty harsh words along those lines. And one has to ask about all this pushback now, if this is going to have any effect whatsoever.
I think they can't really legally extend his sentence just because of his beliefs, right? He was originally sentenced to 20 years. And even at the time, it was known that that could get reduced for good behavior. And, you know, the Bureau of Prisons made its decision. So, you know, and he has 3 years of supervised release. He's going to be on a pretty tight leash. Probation officers are not going to allow him to, for example, have an internet-enabled device without permission. He's not allowed to communicate on the internet in any language other than English. All of his communications are going to be monitored. So to the extent that we're worried about the risk of him trying to radicalize other individuals, things like that, you know, I think that at least for the next 3 years, we've got a pretty good handle on it. Though there's still an open question of what happens after those 3 years take place. But I understand why politicians are condemning the release, but it seems a little odd from my perspective for the Secretary of State to be weighing in on what's essentially a Department of Justice issue.
Well, what do we make out of the fact that the Bureau of Prisons back in 2017 made an assessment and they cited that essentially he was supposedly, according to them, in support of the Islamic State? And your colleague, Graham Wood, who wrote a book on ISIS, who's been featured on this program, had a correspondence with him and also said he's an ISIS supporter.
Right. Yeah. And this is a really difficult this is a really difficult problem. So he got the sentence that he got. The idea was that, you know, the assumption of the criminal justice system is you serve your time, you get out, you reintegrate into society. We have a lot of concern now in the post-September 11th era about people's ideology and beliefs, but it's still not a crime to hold certain beliefs. And if you look at the correspondence that he had with Graham Wood, he was asking a lot of questions about the Islamic State. It's hard to tell from the documentation that's currently available just what exactly the status is of his belief or possible support for the Islamic State. So far, we only have that correspondence and some things from the Bureau of Prisons. So we don't have a lot of detail about whether that support entails, you know, support for attacks on the United States, for example, or what actually is the nature of it. But again, it's not a crime to hold extremist beliefs. It's a crime to act on them.
We should mention, though, that in 2002, at his sentencing, he condemned terrorism and actually denounced bin Laden's attacks on the United States and said he was mistaken to join the Taliban. So this is murky, and we don't know what's going to happen after 3 years, like you said. But there's a bigger issue in some ways than just John Walker Lynn, which you raise in your writing, which I want to call listeners' attention to and hear what you have to say about. And that is that you got hundreds of jihadists, essentially, who are going to be released. In fact, you got a couple who were far worse by, I suppose, most people's thinking than what John Walker Lynn might have been. Somebody wanted to bomb the subway system in New York and another wanted to bomb the Long Island Railroad. And they got half the time that John Walker Lynn got. And in Europe, they have ways to work with de-radicalizing and reintegrating people like this into the society. We don't have anything really here, do we?
Not at the federal level. There are some experiments at the, you know, at the state and local level. So, for example, Minnesota is the example that's mainly cited as sort of the model for this kind of thing, because that jurisdiction dealt with a lot of people trying to, well, dealt with a lot of heavy recruitment on behalf of both the Somali al-Qaeda affiliate al-Shabaab and ISIS. Recruitment efforts targeted at their large Somali immigrant population. So they have a lot of experience relative to other districts in the United States dealing with these kinds of prisoners. The problem is, and it's actually kind of, if you look at it one way, a good problem to have, there aren't really enough of these types of prisoners. There are hundreds out of a population, you know, a bigger prison population of about 2 million people in the United States. There just is not enough data within the United States on what works, nor is there a whole lot of data even among places that have more experience with this, like Germany. And we don't know, for example, whether tailored interventions substantially different from things that you would do for things for people like gang members, you know, mental health counseling, vocational training. We don't really know what specialized interventions might be necessary in cases like these relative to other types of crime.
We're talking, if you've just joined us, with Kathy Gilsonan. She's national security reporter for The Atlantic. And you may want to indeed weigh in on your thoughts about the release of John Walker Lynn and about other jihadists who are about to be released, in fact, hundreds of them. And you can give us a call right now and let us know your thoughts or any questions or comments you might have. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That number again, toll free, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email any questions you might have or your responses to forum@kqed.org. Kathy Gilsonan, there was a bipartisan letter that went out to Hugh Hurwitz, who's the acting head of the Bureau of Prisons. And it was a letter from Republican Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama, as well as Democrat Maggie Hansen of New Hampshire. Essentially what they said was, what's being done about training parole officers or non-governmental partners to recognize signs of violent radicalization or, for that matter, recidivism? And I guess the answer, again, is not much, or if anything.
Yeah, the answer is we don't have a plan yet. The answer is that we're talking about it. Bureau of Prisons knows about this issue. Probation and Parole knows about this issue. And they're still at the very beginning of the planning stages to try and develop a federal program for this. And so what you have is sort of this, not a lot of consistency, sort of this patchwork of state and local programs. And, you know, it is a valid question to raise. We've had 17, 20 years to deal with this. Was the assumption that these folks were never going to get out, or were we just worried about putting them away and not really thinking through what happens after that?
Well, here's a comment from a listener who says, if he served the dictated sentence, then he should be released, regardless of his lingering ideas. We punish deeds, not ideas. And William asks, will Mr. Lynn receive preferential treatment or attention not available to other released prisoners?
I don't know the specific answer to that. I guess in the sense of attention, he will get mental health counseling as part of his supervised release. And there are, as I mentioned, some restrictions on his internet activity and things like that over and above what you would typically get, you know, the kinds of restrictions usually placed on released convicts on probation. So in that sense, he does get specialized attention.
Well, he is going to get mental health counseling. At least that's in the reports that I've been reading.
Right. Yeah.
But not allowed to communicate with any extremist, even though he's apparently communicated with some while he's been in prison?
I am not sure about the communication with extremists while in prison, but you might have more information on that than I do. I know that while he was in prison, his communications were obviously heavily monitored. In fact, he was in one of few prisons in the country that allows for specialized monitoring of convicts like that. So I don't know about current or former communication with extremists, but definitely as a condition of his release, he's not going to be able to do that.
Well, in Graham Wood's article, he writes about John Walker Lynn referring him to an Islamic scholar who was also convicted of jihadist acts, terrorist acts, in fact. I don't know that they were in communication, but there was at least that sense of trying to provide a pipeline of some sort. And the big irony in all this that looms over it is the United States wants peace talks now with the Taliban.
Exactly. Yeah. And well, this is what to me was so interesting about Lynn as almost, you know, he's an individual, he's a human being, he's also been made out to be a symbol, and was, as you mentioned, there have been people that have gotten out of prison already for much more severe crimes. And, you know, one scholar I spoke to pointed out to me that possibly because he became the focus of all this grief and anger after September 11th, had he been convicted, you know, a year or two later, he might have gotten a shorter sentence. And so, of course, the irony now is that the specific crime of which he was convicted was supporting the Taliban. And now that we're, you know, and he did so before September 11th, and he gets out of prison at a moment where the United States is trying to hold peace talks with the Taliban, considered paying its travel expenses to get to the peace talks, which you could look at as material support, even though it hasn't happened. And so it just underscores really how long this war has gone on and how much has changed in the meantime.
In the meantime, let's get our callers involved in this. And again, you can join us toll free right now at 866-733-6786. Here's Martin. Martin's joining us from Santa Clara. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Real quick, my comment is, you know, first, if we think he's under a tight leash, anybody that needs to act quickly, the parole system isn't going to control them in any way, shape, or fashion. They're serial killers that kill immediately after they're on parole. I mean, so I don't believe that, you know, is necessarily something that a tight leash is really a correct term. And then also, I think about, you know, ideology, you know, we look at how the Manson girls were, you know, continue to be in prison, right, for obviously for an ideology concept, in my mind anyway, versus someone that has and could carry out mass killings. So anyway, I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Although what you call the Manson girls, we're talking about like Leslie Van Houten. They were convicted of murder, quite more serious capital crime. Kathy Gillison, you want to comment on the callers?
Well, I think it does raise a point, though, that we do think about ideology in terms of sentencing people, right? You can get, if you commit a sort of an ordinary crime with an ideological component to it, you can get a longer sentence. You can get a longer sentence for some kind of assault, for example, that is seen to be a hate crime. And that essentially is criminalizing ideology. So we do definitely do it in the criminal justice system, and we take ideology into account as a risk factor for the likelihood that someone is likely to commit a violent crime. But the fact remains that absent action, ideology itself is not a crime.
And we're talking with Kathy Gillison, who is national security reporter for The Atlantic. He might wind up back in Marin County. He's going to Virginia initially, but he certainly could be back here. Parents are still here, I believe. In fact, the Spans, whom I mentioned before, the parents of Johnny Michael Spann, the CIA operative who was in the prison and who was killed by the extremists there, and whose parents still are very angry at John Walker Lynn, and very angry particularly, we ought to mention, about comments from his father, who said that the only difference between Johnny Spain and my son, well, there's no difference. They're victims of the same circumstances, which is kind of strange to many people who think of John Walker Lynn as a traitor. Let me get a caller on from Palo Alto. Michael, that's you. You're on.
Referring to the last comment, I think we're all victims of this whole charade. John Walker was a 20-year-old confused kid. He was found in a kind of the wrong place at the right time for the Bush administration. We needed a scapegoat for our entreaties into the Middle East. And You know, he was his mother was a board member of an organization that I was running at the time, and you know, it was this whole trauma. Their family was going through another upheaval, and John was just a kid who got caught in this thing, and the Bush administration needed a scapegoat. When they captured him, they put him on the deck of a ship that they shipped him over here. He was almost naked. All of the, in a horrible situation, and it was perfect opportunity for the Bush administration to have a scapegoat and somebody they can kind of beat around a little bit. It was really sad, and he does not pose a threat to our nation or anybody at this point in time. I hope he gets out. I hope he's treated well by the community.
Well, Michael, I thank you for that call. And Kathy Gilson, and that is one of the strong views about John Walker Lynn that we keep hearing. He's just, in fact, heard from his parents, just a kid who was taken to Islam because he read the autobiography of Malcolm X and was drawn to Islam and the idea of making the trip to Mecca, and became like a scholarly kid who just joined up against the Northern Alliance with the Taliban and you know, just a naive kid, basically. But then you hear the other side of that, which is, you know, a traitor and fighting against forces that were linked to al-Qaeda and actually part of an al-Qaeda camp for a while, met bin Laden even.
Yeah, and the problem is that a lot of this is murky. So his father has made the argument in public that had he, and in fact his defense attorney has made this argument at the time, that had he done the exact same activities but for September 11th, nobody would have noticed. Nobody would have cared what he did. His defense attorneys at the time compared him to other Americans who had gone to fight and say, you know, the Ernest Hemingway went to fight in the Spanish Civil War, things like that. I think the difference is at the time that John Walker Lynn joined the Taliban, it was a crime to join the Taliban. And the Taliban had, it was publicly known that the Taliban had sheltered al-Qaeda, and it was publicly known that al-Qaeda had staged attacks on United States interests. Whether or not, you know, John Walker Lynn maintained that he never joined the Taliban to fight Americans, and he joined the Taliban to help them establish and protect their Islamic State in Afghanistan. So you do have to take that seriously. But you also have to take seriously the fact that, you know, you cannot, I think I sympathize with Franklin's assessment that his son's activities, the reason his son became such a scapegoat was because of September 11th. But you can't escape the fact of September 11th, and you can't escape the fact of the Taliban having sheltered al-Qaeda.
I get a response to you from a listener named Abdul who writes, I guess if you're an Islamic extremist, you're a terrorist that needs to be locked up or monitored. If you're a white supremacist extremist, then you're very fine people, and the president has your back.
This is a very I don't want to necessarily say this is fair, because I think that there are, you know, definitely officials that I talk to are very aware of the problem, the growing problem of white supremacist terrorism. And there are many officials who are perfectly happy to call white supremacist terrorism terrorism with a T. But there's no doubt that historically, since September 11th, the justice system has treated these kinds of essentially political crimes differently, and has, and, you know, and in popular culture, in the media, there's also no doubt that the T word is much easier to apply to an Islamic extremist than to a white extremist. And there's always debate over it. You know, when there's a terrorist attack that is motivated by white supremacist ideology, you know, you'll see sort of an inevitable debate in the media about whether to call this guy a terrorist. Is this terrorism? You know, if you see somebody do the same thing and pledge allegiance to ISIS, there's no debate. It's terrorism. That's what it is. So I certainly take the point.
And let's take another caller. Josh, that's you. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question about the terms of John Walker Lynn's parole, particularly what to me seems like a fairly draconian restriction in regards to that he can only read material in English. And I wonder what effects this might have on things like recidivism and his ability to rejoin society after being imprisoned at a very young age in terms of his adulthood, and whether there's legal precedents for things like restricting what languages we can read in.
Yeah, let me go back to you, Kathy Gilson.
That's a great question. There's definitely precedent for internet restrictions. I have not personally seen the restriction on English communication. I think there's nothing in the terms of his release that prevents him from reading in another language, but he can't communicate in English or in languages other than English. Sorry. The reason for these restrictions, of course, is that people and similar types of restrictions have been applied in terms of internet use in the past on other people in the probation system, because, of course, the concern is that even absent a physical crime, everybody's really concerned about, you know, the spread of ideology on the internet and incitement and recruitment to ISIS and things like that. And as for the other part of the question and how it affects his ability to reintegrate into society, I think that's also a great question. And that's what people say when they don't know the answer to the question.
Well, they did say in the terms of his parole that he should have no communication to any extent with anyone who is a terrorist or is working
right.
with terrorist views or has anything in that context. That's pretty hard to monitor, though. I mean, a lot of these people are under the radar, and you don't know that they necessarily are espousing even terrorist views.
Right. Yeah. That would require. And this gets to another question, which is to the point about whether or not the probation system is equipped to handle these types of cases. It's extraordinarily time and resource intensive to have to monitor people's communications and enforce a rule like no communication with extremists and no possession of extremist materials. You would have to know who the extremists are, which implies research into everybody John Walker Lane communicates with. That's an enormous task for a probation officer, or even a set of probation officers. So one of the problems in coming up with a nationwide system, and I think perhaps one of the reasons it hasn't been prioritized, is there's an expense to this, right? And you have to apply resources, round-the-clock resources, essentially, to a population that people have been content to think were put away and not given much thought to in a long time.
I'm going to read a comment from Lorlene, who writes, I always felt sorry for him. He was obviously neglected by his rich Marin County parents and as a result fell into it with a bad crowd who corrupted his growing young mind. He'll surely be reabsorbed into the elite society he sprang from. Somebody is probably working on a tell-all book that will explain his motives to a befuddled public. Can't necessarily predict where he's going to go or where he's going to live at this point, but at least initially he'll be in Virginia and under some pretty strict monitoring. Talking with Kathy Gilsonen, and we'll continue. I'm Michael Krasny.